Hey everyone, welcome to Guards of Eden. Today's guest is Bryce Michael Wood. I was introduced to Bryce through his platform For Your Discomfort. And For Your Discomfort is a platform that looks to provide an education through observation of conversation. And I hope I've got that wordplay right. What I found with the platform was Bryce had managed to build something in a time where the world was mourning the death of George Floyd, and I say the world because of just the grotesque nature of what was videoed that for that 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And not only that, but we were experiencing a global pandemic, and there was a lot of emotional and mentally taxing circumstances that we were all going through. But I think being able to provide a voice for black men and women at that time, I love the way that he went about hosting these conversations and providing just a safe space for people to vocalize how they were thinking and feeling. The episode I'm just incredibly proud of, in full transparency. I just found the way that he portrayed his story was something that even I got lost in it during the interview, which is obviously quite strange for me to experience as a host slash producer at that time. And I'm just incredibly grateful for his time and energy. And please go check out For Your Discomfort. I do believe that there is value in every single episode. And I do mention that in this episode, that they're incredibly informative, incredibly educational. And they are symbolic of how great Bryce is. And it's no accident that the episodes are as valuable and consistently valuable as they are. So I can't wait for you to hear this conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Please go show Bryce some love, show him some support, and let's get into this. I'm going to steal Bryce's intro. It feels very apropos. So 3, 2, 1, step into the room. Hey Bryce, how are you doing?
I'm good. How you doing, man?
I'm good. Let's get into it, because I know you're busy and I really appreciate you taking your time out. So the first question, I have the Guards of Eden soundtrack, which is a Spotify playlist, and it is each guest gives me a song that reminds them of a happy memory or makes them feel good. And I was wondering, do you have a song that you kind of go to make you feel good, or something that you look back and go, oh, that really reminds me of this really great time?
Yeah, absolutely. First off, thanks, Lucas, for having me and reaching out and being so supportive with the show and everything that I've been doing over here. It doesn't go unnoticed. A song that makes me happy, and it's not linked to a specific memory, but a song that makes me happy is definitely When Doves Cry by Prince.
Yes.
So good.
Oh man, I'm a big Prince fan, so that's hit me right in the heart. I'm a big Prince fan.
great.
Well, that's gonna live on there now, and I love it. Starting out as a young Bryce Michael Wood, were you born and raised in Arizona?
Yes, born and raised Phoenix, Arizona, South Phoenix. I'm not gonna give the address, but I grew up on a beautiful lane, and it was called Beautiful Lane.
Oh, I love it. What was a young Bryce like?
You know, a young Bryce was very much too grown up. I was very grown up as a little kid as far as how I spoke. I think I thought I was an adult when I was young. I was an only child, and I think it's because my parents talked to me like an adult that I sort of operated like an adult in adult spaces where I was supposed to be a kid. So. Got me into a lot of trouble, Luca.
Really?
Yeah, for sure.
One thing that I read up on was your amazing mom.
Yes.
She was the founder of the Black Mothers Forum in Arizona.
Yeah. And you
spoke about speaking at a protest. I want to say it was a protest or a rally that was going on in Arizona not long ago. What was it like growing up with what I'd imagine was an amazing mom, but even better, just a female role model that she used her platform? And can you kind of talk to how great she is as a woman?
Sure. Yeah. My mom, I always describe her as Wonder Woman. because she literally has done and will continue to do all of it, everything. She can do it all. Growing up with her, this was kind of like how it went. So she started off, she was like in insurance, but she thought she was going to be a lawyer. So like that was happening for a little bit when I was younger. Then she became the chief of staff to the mayor in Phoenix. And so then she got into local, you know, government at the city level. And then she decided to run for governor. I want to say my senior year of high school going into my freshman year of college, and she almost won. Like it was so random, but that kind of gives you sort of that's the woman I was growing up with. And then on the flip side, she was also a minister, and we ended up leaving the church that we were a part of, and then she set up a church called First Watch, and it was in the streets, and it was for essentially homeless people. Like we would go set up tents, bring food, and we would have church in the park and like just invite a whole, you know, all the homeless people that were there. And I was doing that around 12 or 13. So, and it was like just me and my mom and her friends, you know, and people that, you know, believed in what she was doing. And she, you know, started a whole organization. We ended up buying like a house, kind of like a halfway house, to get people off the streets and transition them back into, you know, getting a job and paying bills, and then like get them to be able to buy their own house. But that's just a little taste of like the kind of woman I grew up with as a role model. She really taught me the value of caring about people the most, because she just cares about people.
That's amazing. Yeah. So I know you would go to college and kind of take this up, but you were big track and field guy, right? Growing up.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
What did you enjoy about sports growing up? Because I know you kind of went into a fitness profession, but what did kind of sports give you growing up?
You know, what's funny about how, you know, the question you asked just before this is the person I probably looked up to the most was my dad. Because he's from Jamaica, mm-hmm. and he went to college in the States on a track and field scholarship, and, you know, almost made it to the, I don't remember, maybe the 96 Olympics. He'll correct me whenever he hears this, but he you know, he was going to do that, and, you know, suffered an injury, and then, you know, then I came along and like family and life. But he's definitely the reason I got into sports. As far as the person that kind of encouraged me to, and I just wanted to, he's a track coach now. He's a college track coach now. And I grew up with, you know, going to practices with him at whatever high school he was a coach at. And I was always like this little kid in like sort of grown up spaces. So even just hanging out with high school kids and like their practices and stuff like that. But look, at my favorite sport growing up was American football. That was my jam. That was my favorite thing. And I just knew I was going to the NFL. So like,
what team did you support?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I'm from Arizona, so the Arizona Cardinals. Uh-huh. But growing up, I ranged. I think the first team I was a fan of was the Denver Broncos because of my grandpa, Tommy, because he was from Denver. And then when I was able to make my own decisions, I think I started rooting for the Ravens because they won the Super Bowl in, I think, 2000. And that was the first Super Bowl I like took in as a kid and like understood what was happening. And I just loved Ray Lewis and was like, I'm going to be a middle linebacker, and I'm going to the NFL to play for the Ravens. Then I started to lean out a little bit and got faster. And then I started to like Chad Johnson, a.k.a. Chad Ochocinco. he became one of my favorite wide receivers to watch. So then naturally I became a Bengals fan. And then in high school I calmed it down and just started rooting for the home team. We started to catch some steam. Maybe it was 08 or 09, Steelers Cardinals in the Super Bowl. I think it was 09. And then I was like, okay, I can root for the home team. We don't suck. And I've been a Cardinals fan ever since.
I love it. I'm a big NFL fan. Like, like nerdy. So I am a Patriots fan. So, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Cam Newton.
Yes. The jersey. So my Cam Newton jersey is at the post office now.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. I ordered it the day they finalized the contract. And I guessed his number. I think he's going to wear one. So I'm kind of hoping he wears one. Otherwise, yeah, my jersey's going to look a bit crazy. So, because I did the whole, like, put your own name, but put his name and then number one on it. But,
yeah.
Yeah, so I've, and then I played a season in college.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, what I mean, position? So the funny thing is, I'm 5'7". 5'7", is, like, real height. And I was super big. They put me on the offensive line.
No way.
Yeah, so I mean, British college football's like, I mean, you'd put like an American high school team against us and we'd get beaten pretty heavily, I feel like. So you've got to like compare the standard, but it's I went to play center and my hands were too small when it was raining, so I was trying to snap and then block a D tackle and so they moved me around, so I became like all over the offensive line. But yeah, so
I started off on the offensive line.
Really?
That's where I started. I was a big kid. I was a very big, I grew fast. I was tall early. And like when I was a little kid in like Pop Warner, probably like around 9 or 10, I was just a bigger kid. Like I was like a chubbier, tall kid. And then once I started to gain some athleticism, they started to move me around. And eventually we landed at wide receiver and free safety.
Oh. Yeah. So all the action.
I love to hit, Lucas. That was my favorite part of football was the contact. So I wasn't juking people. I was like running into them once I got the ball. Like, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I love that, man. Yeah, I my first Super Bowl I watched was because I only took the Patriots up in like 2012. So the Eli beat them that year, and then I've picked it up properly after that and took the Patriots then, but. The first Super Bowl I remember kind of seeing was the David Tyree one. So I think that was like 07.
Oh, wow.
With the helmet catch and stuff. So
Yeah.
But NBA and NFL are like, they're two big sports that are kind of probably like my two favorite sports. But, well, basketball and American football, but leagues. I don't know college stuff. But massive tangent. And I apologize for that. But
no, it's totally great. But you asked about track. So grew up running club track. Was blessed to have my dad as a coach, a blessing and a curse, because we were just always less father son, more coach athlete.
Right.
And he, you know, track specifically outside of football just taught me the value of hard work and consistency and what it means to be disciplined, because I didn't have your normal childhood because of track and field and how serious me and my dad took it as far as like the national, international level and being ranked always and like having goals of like being the best. And, you know, I was a high hurdler, 110, like the 110 highs, you know, all the way through college.
God bless you, man. Hurdling, that stuff does not look fun.
It's the best. It's the best.
You have to be a special athlete. Something that you spoke about that I found really interesting, you were saying growing up, although you grew up in a community that was like predominantly black, you went to a school where there was a lot more white people. How did you find what I'm imagining is just like such a like juxtaposition of cultures in the two places that you spend the vast majority of your time, like growing up as a kid?
As a kid, I think you just adapt. As a kid, I think you're not really, you know, thinking, you're not looking at it critically, you know, you're just existing in the two spaces. So while I was doing it, I don't know that I was ever cognizant of like, how is this making me feel? You know, I just kind of would roll with the punches. What I will say is I think sort of the great middle ground was the home I grew up in, right? Like just having my mom and my dad there, because they provided a good balance for me to understand like who I am, where I come from, these are your people, but also this is how you need to be in order to be successful in this predominantly white space. You're one of like, I was talking to my dad about this maybe right before I left to come back to New York, but I could count on I can count on one hand, you know, the amount of black people that were in my class, you know, moving through the school I was in. There was me and my friend Baird and this girl, Kimberly. And then I think the grade below, there were two Camerons. And like that was it, you know, and I still know their names. I know their faces to this day because subconsciously you always look for people that look like you. And we didn't necessarily, I mean, I was best friends with Baird, but we didn't all necessarily hang out, but like, you know, that they exist and that they're there. But I would say the bigger struggle, if you will, or the bigger thing I noticed coming back to my neighborhood, because I was, you know, different from everybody else in the neighborhood just based on how I spoke and how I dressed even and how I acted. So once you get into like your teenage years, you want to be accepted and start to fit in. And that's kind of when I started to figure that out.
Yeah, see, it's so funny, right? Because in my head, because I do my best to do that when I'm kind of thinking of the questions, to kind of think like, oh, if that was me, how would I feel? And I was thinking that you were going to go the other way. So you were going to say like school was kind of a bit, you maneuver around and then you kind of get home and there's like a sigh of relief and an exhalation of just like, oh, I'm back home. But do you remember what age you were when you kind of started realizing like, oh shit, like, because I've been at this kind of predominantly white school, it's actually kind of alienating me a small part when I get home.
Yeah, it was probably, honestly, I'm going to say a name I haven't like said in a long time, but honestly, like my cousin, his name is Keenan, he didn't go to those kinds of schools, right? Like he got to sort of stay in his lane, so to speak, and like go to the more public schools in our neighborhood. And he, hanging out with him, was sort of like my smooth transition because he would like just straight up call me out like, bro, that's not cool. Or like, why do you talk like that? What are you doing right now?
Yeah.
But he never made me feel bad. You know what I mean? He never made me feel like I didn't belong or that I was different or weird. He was just like, this is what's cool. This is what's not cool. Right. So it was less about, this is how you know, this is what black people are. Like, it wasn't that, because obviously I am black, but it was more about just like he was a smooth transition, because I would ask him, I'd be like, why do people make fun of how I talk? Or like, why isn't it cool to be smart? Or like, why do you get all the girls? Like, why do girls keep talking to you so much? Like, and I'd be like, cause I don't know. Cause I'm like, I take school very serious, like all these things. And I kind of learned from him. And not even just asking questions, I would just watch. Which probably led to my acting ability today. I would just watch and mimic and be like, okay, this is how I should walk, talk, sound, present myself, so that A, I'm taken seriously, and B, I'm not made fun of. But the first experience I had, Luca, was at a Pop Warner football practice in my neighborhood, South Phoenix, on the South Side. We should also talk about why black people are always on the South Side. Another topic for another day.
Yeah, right.
Another topic for another day. But I grew up in South Phoenix on the South Side, and like my Pop Warner team was like, we were called like the South Side, like South Pop Warner. So anytime we played anybody else, they're like, here comes the South Side. Only black kids on the team, and it's just black and Mexican kids. But that was like my first like kind of just getting thrown into the water. I guess I was like 11 maybe, of just like, my dad just dropped me off, my mom and dad just dropped me off, all these people, and I was like, this is the most black people outside of my family, obviously, that I've just been, like, I'm just here now. And everybody's talking different. I can't really understand everybody. And everybody's looking at me like I'm an alien, talking weird. But sports definitely helped me bridge that gap, because then I was just gifted. And people were like, okay, it doesn't matter. He could play or whatever. So it's fine.
Yeah, that's the thing. Anybody that I know that, like, grew up in sporting backgrounds, I think growing up and playing in team sports or playing in any kind of sport where there is like an element of team is, it does give you a fresher perspective on the world. Cause once again, like you said, it's like, we don't really care how you look. We don't care what you do in your spare time. We don't care. A lot of the things we kind of let go, and it's like, can you play? And if you can, are you like a kind of a good dude to play with in terms of pause, but in terms of like in the sport? But I always feel like you have a fresher perspective on the world. And I think it gave me a lot growing up as a kid, like playing team sport and in terms of just culture integration and kind of giving me a deeper understanding of the world, even at like a young age. Like you said, maybe you're not conscious of it at the time, but now I go, oh, okay, cool. It was just, you know, I played team sports with, like, you know, that person, and it kind of gave me an insight into that kind of lifestyle. Or, you know, yeah, I just, it's always intrigued me, and I kind of thought, as someone that I look at what you've built now, it's, I'm imagining it's had a big impact growing up.
Absolutely. If I feel like it's, I will always give sports almost 90% of the credit for everything, for the person that I am. And that involves everyone that has supported me in it, or, you know, was a coach, or, you know, my parents and all of that. But like sports, the discipline that comes with it, but also just the ability to adapt in the moment, the ability to have a short-term memory as it pertains to keeping like the overall goal as what's important, instead of like these little plays in between getting to the goal. Like, as long as there are points on the board and as long as we have a W at the end of it, we'll work on the rest. But look, we got the dub as a group together, figured it out. So yeah, I will all, like, sports, without sports, I'm not the actor I am. I'm not the activist I am. I'm not the son, boyfriend, any of that, you know?
Yeah. I love it. And you've mentioned acting. You, you then go to Notre Dame. English people are going to hate me pronouncing it that way, but I am going to use the American pronunciation. But
instead of Notre Dame?
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to say Notre Dame, and you went and studied.
There you go.
I want to get this right. Was it film and television?
Eventually. It was actually marketing. I went to be a business major. And then towards the end, whenever we get into that story, then some things started to shift. And then I ended up minoring in film and TV.
That's the thing, right? That's a really big difference between England and America when it comes to college, is that we kind of go in, and although you can maybe manipulate it along the way, like early on, it's kind of like, really, you go and study one thing, and then it's just like, dude, you're locked in. You've got options. But it's like, because I went and studied fitness management and personal training and just hated my degree. I ended up dropping out, but I kind of realized that I was more into writing. I kind of wanted to do more journalism. They didn't let me because it wasn't in the scope of my degree. But so that's a big thing. But anyway, you talked about acting, and it's something I find really interesting. Do you know when you kind of picked up that? Because I don't know how, because it's something I've never got into. I've got no idea like how the passion is born, how it's kind of curated. And so when did acting come, like, become a big part in your life? And do you remember like what it gave you early on in life?
Acting became a big part in my life literally at the University of Notre Dame. Around like age, what was that, 20 maybe? Uh-huh. But I will say, my mom reminds me always, now that this is like my actual, you know, career path and passion, that when I was younger, I was in like show choir, and I was always like a jokester and like always center of attention. Like, that's what, you know, if I was getting sent to the office, it's because I was like a whole stand-up comedian in class. And she reminded me, like, at the after-school programs, I would literally have like a mix CD, put it in like the boombox, get on a stage, and like just perform for them. Nobody asked me to do this. I just did it. I just was like, this is what I'm doing for you. Fast forward, sports happen. I don't care about any of the artistic stuff anymore. and I'm just like a jock and a student, like full time, just like books and sports. So I let that go. Then you get me to the University of Notre Dame, pursuing a marketing degree on a track scholarship. And I need to take a fine arts, you know, credit. Like, I just need to get my fine arts credit. Elective. So I think I had taken like a theater class in high school. It was fun and it was like easy. So I was like, cool, I'll do that here, get an easy A. And we did a two-person scene on camera in front of the whole class for one of the projects. And then the professor afterwards pulled me aside and was like, you should do this. You should come audition for like my play. And I told him no, you know, like, no, I don't have time for that. I'm on, you know, I have practice every day. I don't want to do that. I'm not interested in this. Yeah. And then he told me he'd give me extra credit. And I was like, start with that. I'll obviously do your play for extra credit. Like, what do you, absolutely, I'll do your play, you know? So I audition, I do it. I fall in love instantly because, you know, people were laughing at what I was doing. And it finally felt like the right place to do it. It was appropriate. I was like, oh, this is where I can be like this. This is where, it's appropriate to kind of let this other side of myself out in a productive way and not a disruptive way. That was cool. Anyway, I love wordplay. You have to know this.
But 100%.
Yeah, that's where I didn't really take a whole lot of acting classes because it was hard to really like just switch up the degree because it was my junior year. Mm-hmm. But we decided to do a minor instead. And so I took a class called our audition seminar. That was it. I took an audition seminar class and one like acting 101, I think. And I did a lot of student short films. And then the faculty there really, really encouraged me to audition for grad school for acting, which is expensive, but they actually ended up helping me, you know, pay for all the things because they believed in what I could do, which was great. Shout out to theater department at the University of Notre Dame. Thank you for seeing something in me that I couldn't see in myself. I go audition for these grad schools, get a full ride to the University of Connecticut, and still, Luca wasn't really passionate about it. Was just kind of, I just kind of showed up to see. I mean, it was paid for. I was like, all right, I don't have to be an adult yet. I'll just go to some more free school and see what's up. And so that first year was great. It was fine. I learned stuff, but it wasn't until that first summer at a theater that I worked at in Cape Cod, Monomoy Theater, with the director, Francesca James, who's like an Emmy nominated, Emmy winning like daytime TV director. And she directed Summer Stock Theater for fun, I guess. I don't know. But she's great. She didn't have to be there, but she was. And she challenged me in a way that reminded me of sports, I think. And she opened my eyes to a lot of what acting could be. And she's always going to kind of get that nod, whether she knows it or not. Like, I'm always shouting out Francesca James's name because without her, I'm not this. Without her, I'm not passionate about the craft. Because then after that summer, I went back to my next 2 years of acting grad school and was like locked in and like wanted it all. And like I needed to have all of the tools to be as good as I could be. And fast forward, I'm in New York, signed, and I've been working, and it's been great.
So when I think of Notre Dame, I think of a really strict religious college. And it's, I don't know, but is it it's also a super white college, right? Is from what I've seen. Because we've spoken about American football, so I think of the Fighting Irish team and all of that stuff. Manti Te'o was there. I won't get into that.
Hey, now. My guy, though. We were there at the same time. He's a good guy. That's a great guy.
Yeah. How did you find what I'm assuming was like quite a, I'm going to say strict, from just a real kind of naive perspective and real, like, I guess ignorant, for a lack of a better term, in terms of my perception of the college. But was it like a typical, what you heard was a typical college experience?
No.
No.
No, not even kind of. I grew up, I grew up 15 minutes away from Arizona State University, which was always voted like number one party school in the nation when I was growing up. So I thought college was something very different than what Notre Dame was. And I think strict is appropriate. I think a lot of rules, there were just a lot of things that you had to comply with in order to be a student there and stay there, for sure.
Yeah. And do you see yourself as Fighting Irish or a Husky? Which one more?
Fighting Irish, 1,000%. Yeah. And it's because I played sports there. There's no way that I could ever actually be a Husky. And I said that when I was there, so I don't feel bad about saying it now. my best friend, Kayla McBride, she was on the women's basketball team at Notre Dame, and now she plays for like the Las Vegas Aces? Yeah, she's in the WNBA. And so I went to every game, every women's basketball game, and those were like their rivals, UConn and Notre Dame. Women's basketball specifically are rivals. So she felt betrayed that I even accepted a scholarship to go there.
I was about to say, UConn is like the women's basketball like sanctuary, right, in terms of just how the good people...
It's UConn. No, it's Notre Dame, UConn, and Baylor.
Yeah.
And like Stanford, and like Oregon now,
with Sabrina,
and Maryland, Yeah. But if you've ever watched women's college basketball, Notre Dame and UConn are always number one and number two interchangeably every single year for infinity and beyond. Like, that's just what it is.
But I like it. You stuck with the original college. I like it.
Oh, it's because I competed there, man. I got my letter. I got letters there. I'm on the wall there. Like, so many dope things. Yeah, no. I didn't even watch UConn sports when I went there. I was always watching Notre Dame games.
I love that, man.
I was just being petty. Like, I just was like, no. And I had, like, I was a TA, and so some of the athletes were, like, students of mine, and I was like, don't care. Fine.
Who was the big women's basketball player then? Was it Brianna Stewart? Was it that group? No.
When I was there, like my first year, she was still there. Yeah. And then I think she went to the league after that. But they always have, I mean, all of them. Gabby Williams, who was a student of mine. That's the only one that's coming to mind. But literally just, they always get like the top recruit every time. Yeah. So.
I love it. Can you explain the journey from UConn to New York? Because that was like one part of your journey. I was like, I don't know how you transitioned from there to there.
Sure. We at the end of your third year, you have for all MFA programs and BFA programs, Masters of Fine Arts, you have what's called a showcase. And I won't say for all, but a lot of them have what's called like your showcase. And essentially what it is you have the opportunity to go to New York, Chicago, and LA in front of industry professionals. And it's essentially like your final thing, like your final project. And there are potential implications, right, of like maybe getting signed or cast in a show or at least get an audition. So we had our showcase in 2017 in New York City. I did two scenes with two different classmates of mine in front of just a theater full of agents and casting directors and stuff. And I was very blessed, I will say. I was very fortunate to have sort of the feedback and the response as far as interest come my way. And I'll kind of leave it there because, I don't want to talk like that. But needless to say, I had a showcase. I was signed within like 2 weeks of that showcase. And then I was off to the races in shows and auditions. And it's a crazy life, I promise you.
I love it. Yeah, it was just one thing that when I was like trying to piece your journey and set the timeline in my head, I was like, I get UConn and I know it's kind of close to New York. So, but I was like, I didn't know for sure. A quote of yours that did really stick with me, and it was on your website, that as I was researching, it just kind of like stuck with me and it kind of stayed in my mind for a bit. I kind of want to read it back and just kind of get your thoughts on it / speak to it a bit more. But you said, "My personal goals as an artist in theatre are to inspire the next generations of artists to redefine their craft and continue to want more from their craft. As an African-American actor, I have an opportunity to change the landscape of theatre for all artists of colour." Can you speak to that mission and why that's important for you as like a representation of kind of what your mission is with acting?
That's so funny. I literally wrote that in 2017 and never looked back. So I was in a very specific headspace then. Mm-hmm. But it still rings true now, but I think for different reasons. I think my urge and desire to redefine comes from limited representation in theater and TV and film as far as what the world sees as like a black actor, which sucks, but like that's how we're even, you know, described. We're not just actors, you know, we're black actors. And you know, for the longest, and I love all of the people I'm about to say, but for the longest it was like Will Smith, Denzel Washington, Jamie Foxx, like Samuel Jackson, Viola Davis, Angela Bassett, like Jada Pinkett Smith, Martin Lawrence, like the list kind of goes on, but not really. And that was kind of a lane. And then you would see others come up under them and kind of fall into a lane. Like, are you a comedian Or are you more serious? Are you just a sex symbol, or do you have more to offer? And like everybody kind of just fell into a lane. For me, like there was a lane, there was a very specific lane forming for me. And while I was grateful for that lane because people paved it, you know, before me and I'm happy to be here, I want to always continue to expand and show more, essentially what I've been doing on this show. I just want to show more from my perspective and more, and I want us to want more from it, right? I want us to seek to be viewed in a different light or seek, have a different approach to get the same result. I don't know. Like when I wrote that, I was so in it, Luvia. Like I was so like, I am about to bust on the scene. I'm kicking down doors and I am changing how Black people are viewed in theater. And now that I've gotten there and been able to work with so many beautiful and wonderful artists, like I'm seeing it. I'm seeing what I wanted. And now it's just about everybody else seeing it. You know, I think I was like, it doesn't exist. And like, no, it exists. It's just not promoted. We exist. We're here. We're just not touted. We're not sought after if you're not a name. You know what I mean? Like there are, and I don't want to go over the statistics, but there are so many new white faces on TV and film all the time that aren't like famous or like recognizable. That there are more white actors, specifically white actresses, than there are just Black actors in general. Like unless like we know kind of who you are, have seen you before, you're really not, it's going to be really hard for you to get that gig, right? Like that high paying gig, unless you're a part of that A or B class celebrity group, it's going to be really tough. Whereas for white actors and white actresses, like, I don't know, you're going to get thrown in there. I'm like, cool, great. Never seen you before and you're talented. I'm not going to ever be like, they're not good. I just see it. I just notice it.
Yeah. There's so much that branches off of too.
I know there's so much.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's just, but I mean, I'll say it. There's a lot of like lifetime mediocre white actors and actresses. And you never seem to see that with like Black actors. And like you've mentioned Will Smith, Denzel, Jamie Foxx, Viola Davis. Like it's like you have to be like super sensational and like be super multi-talented. Like you said, they do kind of want to pigeonhole you, but it's like Will Smith has to be like a great actor, rapper, like all these different things, right? To be like the dude. And because it's limited space and it's like you have to be extra talented to just be above the like mediocre white dude like that's had a whole career, like made millions of dollars, and this like, you know, I'll say an actor, but like this guy's just like made a career off being the dude, like he's just the guy. And it's that's kind of, I think that's probably why it stuck with me a bit more, because that kind of was where my train of thought went. But and it's really strange as well, because although you said that was kind of the space you were in then with theater, it's kind of almost verbatim the mission you've ended up going on, and it's just taken a different form of theater in terms of For Your Discomfort, right?
Yeah,
really, in the grand scheme of things, it's like that you want to show that you want to redefine these labels and show that, you know, there's more nuance to the Black experience than there is just like what the media want to portray.
Yeah,
I do want to get into one thing, which is SoulCycle.
Hey now.
Yeah. So we've had it here a year, I think we've had it a year. I've been there. I've really enjoyed it. But my first experience was in Boston when I was there. But one thing I noticed, and it was something that I once again found intriguing with Tramell, and I want to kind of get your idea on it. It's a largely white customer base. How did you find it early on as a Black man and, you know, proud Black man, and you go in and it's a lot of white faces in there? How did you find it early on?
I need to actually ask you about this, but I started off as front desk, right? So
okay.
I was a front desk employee. I was totally happy being a front desk employee because I was in New York to act. Mm-hmm. And I was fine with my part-time job, but I was in Tribeca, which is, you know, a very wealthy, very white area. And, you know, just being in that space, I was the only straight Black man in the building on a given day, just all the time. Right. Like, that's just what it was. So it was interesting, but it wasn't, you know my journey now, yeah. So it wasn't anything I hadn't encountered before. So I was kind of used to it. I think something that I wasn't used to was class, the class of person that takes the soul cycle class, that can afford a soul cycle class in very specific neighborhoods, and sort of the privilege that comes with that. And that's like regardless of your color, that's just like a tax bracket thing. So that was something to learn. But once I became an instructor, speaking to that, sort of what Tramell was talking about, I just think it's very hard to feel like you're going to be successful in a mostly white space based on the stereotypes associated with your outer appearance. It's very hard to initially, once you're thrown out into the market, be comfortable in your own skin, because you're thinking about marketing yourself a certain way, making sure people come to your class, making sure people stay, and making sure people come back. So there's, as a Black man in those spaces, it's just an interesting thing to navigate. As far as just being comfortable in your own skin, and you eventually you get there, but it's not easy when someone comes up to you before a class and it's like, hey, you're not gonna play that rap, are you? And you're like, okay, probably, but like there's other stuff, like you're not gonna play, like it's not gonna be super loud, right? Like I took this other instructor, or they'll just, I took insert Black instructor's name, that's not me, took somebody's class, I took so-and-so's class, and they played a lot of rap, and it was loud. Are you going to do that? And it's like, okay, no, maybe. What are you doing? This is my class. You don't have to be here. Like, it's tough. It's tough to be yourself and be successful, or think that you're going to be successful being yourself. I'll put it that way. It's tough to think you'll be successful being yourself in a predominantly white space, especially in the fitness industry.
Yeah, and it's that class thing again, right? I think that class, if I'm going to generalize, the person that can afford to do that class on a consistent basis, they're more than likely going to be, there's going to be a level of entitlement that you maybe wouldn't get with another class. And there's probably going to be a level of, I'll say blissful ignorance for a lack of better term. Like the fact that because you're paying that amount for a class, they can maybe feel like they talk to you a bit crazy, like that, in terms of, like, in my head, that's a wild thing to just come out and say to someone, to say, are you just going to play that music? Like, for me, that's very wild. So yeah. I think maybe that speaks to the class as well as obviously the racial kind of connotations that come with that. But
there's a flip side to it too. There are also people that just come to your class because they assume, in a positive way, they're like, but you are going to play that, right? Like, I'm here because I expect you to play that kind of music. It's double-edged, and not everybody's like that. I've only encountered someone doing that like once or twice, and it was the same person. So I'm not going to be out here like, all soul cycle people are like that. Like, no, that's not the case at all. Soul cycle is great. They're growing. Yeah. We're growing and everyone's learning and trying to be better. But I'm hoping that with everything that's kind of come out of this season, that when I do go back and enter into that space once again, that it's, what's the word? That it's not even progressed, but willing to. I don't expect anything overnight, and I don't want it overnight, because that's, nothing is built overnight. I don't want you to pitch a tent with like straws. Okay. Take the time, weld the metal, let's get this right. But don't just like quick fashion together, like the quick thing to be like, we did it. And I'm like, did you? So that said, I'm just ready for it to be open to the change. And I know they are, like, I've been talking and everything's cool.
That's great. Yeah. I think that's the thing. It's only because you work for Soul that we're saying Soul. It's like, that is like, we call it in here in England, I don't know if it's the same terminology in America, but like the boutique fitness industry, where it's as in it's definitely not kind of company specific, it's it's industry specific more than anything else. But one thing that you spoke about in a For Your Discomfort episode, I can't remember the specific one, and it's something that's never crossed my mind, and I think it's wildly interesting And I think it's wildly interesting to me, and I think it is for other people. And it's this idea of the fetishization of the black man in the fitness industry. And it's something you spoke about it so eloquently, and I don't want to even really kind of try to put words in your mouth. So I'm going to let you kind of explain it, but can you speak to it and kind of, I guess maybe the realization of when you realized that it was a real thing when you were kind of teaching at Seoul and just in the fitness industry in general, and how has it shaped your perception of the industry as a whole through that lens specifically, I guess?
Sure. I would say I first noticed it as a front desk employee. Mm-hmm. Whether it was me, you know, specifically, like people literally assumed I was an instructor all the time. Like all the time. They were like, are you teaching next? And I'd be like, no, I just like say, hey, spray the shoes, clean the bikes. You know, like I just work here. So like, oh, you look like, and you know, I'm in shape. Like I get it, you know, I'm an athlete. So I didn't ever count it against anyone. But I noticed it then. I would notice it with, you know, specific black male instructors that would come teach when I was working front desk, and the clientele that would show up for, you know, said instructor's class. And it was like literally all just like women, specifically like white women, all ages, ranging all ages, getting, you know, done up, wearing their best. And I remember asking that instructor afterwards, like, what's this about? Or like, do you notice this? And he's like, of course I notice this. Like, it's the only reason people come to my class. And I'm like, damn, like that. Like to know that is like one thing, but then to like accept that is another. But personally, I think I realized it when I had, you know, a community ride and nobody knew who I was yet. I hadn't really been on the schedule yet. And all they had was a picture and my stuff sold out. You know, like people were there. And I didn't think about it then. I just was happy. I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know why this happened. Yay, like lucky, so lucky. You know, like, wow, what are the odds? But then realizing sort of like consistently after I got on the schedule, like the clientele and the comments and, you know, where people's hands want to go and like all of those kinds of things and like offers made and DMs and all these different things. And you start to realize why people are in your room, why certain people are in your room. I'm not going to say like to any of my riders that eventually just became my riders. I know that's not why you're there. But it's very apparent when those people are there for that reason. And it's just obvious. There's no like real way to say, like there was a moment when I was still front desk where I literally like a whole, like someone offered to be like a whole sugar mom. Like a whole situation. I was like, what? And they were not shy. And they were blunt. And it was like, I was like a thing, you know? And it was weird. It was weird. I was like, whoa. Really? Really? Are you serious right now? And because I was like broke at the time, I, you know, I was like, well. And I was like, no. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that.
When you're broke,
but it crosses all, you know, it crosses into any athletics, anything. Just like the, you know, Michael Jackson Jr. we had on was the dancer, and we talked about it in his, you know, like just the black male physique for whatever reason is fetishized, like it's a thing.
I do remember the episode now, and it took me back because. So although that I don't know you super personally, I've kind of, you know, been able to make my, you know, judgments and assumptions, I guess, kind of through these conversations that you're having. And I promise you we're getting there. I just, you know, you're a wildly interesting dude. I kind of wanted to cover some of your backstory. But as someone that really is, in my personal opinion, I appreciate it may be a bit uncomfortable for me, you maybe to hear it. But as someone that's intelligent, has this great moral compass, great character, I guess, how do you find it being judged purely on the perception of, you know, your physique in that case, of course in the grand scheme of things the color of your skin, but this idea of having to realize like I'm this, you know, I'm well educated, I'm well spoken, I'm kind, I have this moral compass, I have this perception on the world, which is really engaging for someone to like get to know you and to just be judged on your appearance that way. Like, how did you find that when that realization came?
Devastating. That's my word. Because when I had that realization, it really split the world in half. It split the world in two. It was like, okay, no matter what I do, I'm going to be black and seen as black and, you know, taken in as black and received as black and understood as black and black, right? Like it really, it matters, sure, but on a very small level, yeah. All of the things you just said about me, which I appreciate, but it matters. It seems to matter very little, all of those things, when my appearance and stature come into play. Being a, you know, muscular black man with, and I'm not even using all of my voice, but if I were to speak with my full voice, with a deeper, bigger, powerful voice, I'm perceived as a threat. So even if I navigate around those things and make myself appear smaller and up the pitch of my voice and overly articulate, it doesn't really matter. For some people, a lot of people, and I'm, you know, hoping that change, but my word would be devastating. It sucks to know that I can be as I can hold 2 degrees, I can be kind and all the things you said and still be completely judged on sight.
Yeah.
Or like have people be like, wow, you're more articulate, or wow, I didn't realize you were going to be this like kind, or oh my gosh, you're so much more well-spoken than I thought, or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. It's really funny. Steph Curry said something like this, like really recently, being like, it shouldn't be a surprise to white people that like, a person of color is like well-spoken or intelligent or kind. Like this, right. That's, it's still a point where someone goes, wow, you're really well spoken. And it's like, yeah, dude, don't sound so surprised. Like,
yeah. I mean, like what gets me is just like someone being well spoken has nothing to do with the color of their skin.
No.
Has everything to do with where you grew up and like the education you got, the sounds you grew up hearing, like what you value.
Yeah.
There are so many other races, white people included, that don't sound, that aren't well spoken. You know,
yeah,
that aren't overly articulate. In fact, that go out of their way to be less articulate in order to be quote unquote cool. But yet, as a black person specifically, like there's really no lane you get to pick. That's like fine.
Yeah. Sorry. It's just, yeah. To hear that is just like wildly profound. It's almost a bit challenging to process, but, I am going to take us in a slightly weirder direction, as weird as it sounds, because we've spoken about soul. We're about to speak about For Your Discomfort. But something that I've really noticed about what I guess you as a person, in terms of what I've seen from afar, is that you have this unique ability to bring people together for a purpose that's bigger than themselves. And it's a trait that, well, it's the very like foundation of what I've wanted to build this podcast on, is speaking to people that have that trait in some form or capacity. Do you feel that's a fair assessment of who you are? And is it something that you've had, that maybe it's a trait that you've just kind of accidentally had kind of growing up? Or do you feel like maybe as you've kind of grew up and, you know, matured and found who you are more of as a person, that you've kind of just developed this ability to, and I say it because we're about to speak about For Your Discomfort. I think it really represents that, your ability to bring people together for a bigger purpose. I think Soul Cycle in an element is very similar, in terms of you're asking someone to work hard for a purpose that's bigger than just that 45 minute class. And it just seems like something that's kind of been a running theme of like, especially your adult life, in terms of working in acting. I feel like it's probably very similar, that you've got to commit to something that's bigger than you in terms of the production. But do you feel that's a fair assessment? And yeah, how would you say that's something that is just naturally you kind of growing up, or that you've kind of worked on it growing up?
Thanks for saying all that. I think I want to say before four-year discomfort even happened, it's what's funny is me and my dad, when I first got home during this season, he talked to me about that. We talked about kind of the kind of kid I was growing up and always bring it, literally what you said, like bringing kids together and like kind of cultivating a little group, or bringing kids together that really wouldn't otherwise be hanging out or have any reason to know each other. And like he said, that's kind of like a trait of mine. And this is literally before four-year discomfort even started. And I think he was commenting on, you know, my ability to grow class, or like just, you know, walk into a room and like be fine with whoever's there. So from that standpoint, I think I've always been comfortable bringing people together. But I don't know that it's been a conscious thing like it has been now. Like now it's so conscious that like this is what I'm doing, but I've never even viewed it that way. And so you kind of put it that way. I want the conversations to happen. And when I'm reaching out to people and FaceTiming them when they answer, and talking to them, I'm thinking about, okay, like who would you and again, it's not like a whole conscious thing, it's just happening. It's just like, I don't know what that is, but it's been developed throughout this season. But I would say it's something that's been innate as far as bringing people together that wouldn't otherwise have any reason to speak. That has happened my entire life, but it has not been active like it has been in this season.
Yeah. Super interesting. We're finally at For Your Discomfort. I'm sorry it's taken us this long, but but a platform I really love. It seemed, I don't know if this is true, but was it an evolution? You had been doing a Monday motivation series on Instagram, like a couple videos that I saw. Do you feel like For Your Discomfort was kind of like the evolution of that? And would you say that, like, where was that idea born from in terms of the Monday motivation, which was like an IGTV series that you had started prior to the murder of George Floyd and what that ended up becoming?
Yeah, I mean, someone brought that to my attention. They were like, oh my gosh, this is literally what you had been doing, but for a cause. And that's where it was born out of. I mean, Jonas, who was in part one, he was up next for that following Monday. But then George Floyd happened, and I remember, I didn't even call Jonas first. I should have hit him up first, but I hit up Tramell and Mike because they had already been on Monday Motivation. And I was like, guys, like, I really want to do this. I want to have a conversation, right? And I want to call it For Your Discomfort. Like, it just came to me. I was like, that's what I need to do. Are you down? They were like, we're down. And then I was like, okay, let me talk to Jonas to see if he's cool with us not doing his, like, his own personal segment. And he was super down because he knows them already. And I just didn't feel motivational that particular upcoming Monday, right? Sure. So we had that conversation instead. And it just, you know, blew up. The reason I was doing the Monday motivation was once COVID kind of was set into place and we had to quarantine, you know, I was like, let me do stuff. Like, my writers were like, where are you? Like, are you going to do online classes? And I was like, okay, like, I'll do something. So I had like a Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And Wednesdays like arm day. Fridays was like, you know, core and abs or something. And then Monday was Monday motivation. That was honestly my favorite, you know, part of the week, if I'm being completely honest with you. I really looked forward to motivating people in this season where everyone was so, like, down and discouraged. And I think people forget what that first, like, month was like. Like, that first month was scary, uncomfortable. People are just at home that aren't used to being at home. And, like, jobs are being lost and lives are being lost. And so, and sort of in the spirit of SoulCycle, because there's a motivational and inspirational aspect to SoulCycle, like, I wanted to figure out how I can continue to bring that. And it started with Tramell. And then I realized after Tramell's Monday motivation that this is also, like, It's giving people the ability to get another side of their favorite instructor, right? Yeah. So, or their fitness influencer. This is giving them another side. And it's also giving this fitness person the ability to motivate themselves in this moment and to speak on things that they hadn't realized until they said it out loud. And so it was healing for everybody. It was definitely about healing what Monday Motivation was. Yeah, that's how I would kind of sum that up.
Yeah. Firstly, For Your Discomfort is a fantastic name, by the way. Like,
thanks.
It ended up like, it's super symbolic and like super, it just feels like the perfect name for what it has now become. Can, once again, I feel like you're going to be far better explaining this than me. Can you explain to people that maybe haven't heard For Your Discomfort, what is For Your Discomfort? What was it born from? And what is the intention of it as a platform?
Sure. For Your Discomfort is a series of much needed conversations that relay the perspectives and varying experiences of Black people. It was born out of the George Floyd, Amy Cooper week, that pain, that exhaustion that I felt. I had never felt it before. It was born from the video I posted on Instagram where I just screamed out white people as loud as I could and just kind of gave a piece of my mind in a way that I never had, because I had always been so conscious of protecting a brand and an image and like all of these things that I simply have stopped caring about. Mm. For Your Discomfort is, you know, people really gaining a passion for people and knowing that they don't have to be perfect in this, but that they must be present. It's something I've always said and I'll never stop saying. It's education through observation of conversation. I believe that it is an incredible way to learn. That's it. I'm providing, are hoping to provide, a safe space in order to elevate the voices of those that have been unheard and underrepresented, mainly Black people. And, you know, that'll eventually expand. It's just, I'm very passionate about the Black voice right now in the season we're in.
Rightfully so, first of all. I co-sign with everything you said in terms of it's a phenomenal way to gain an education on the conversation of race, but also, me as a white man, I cannot see the world out, you know, in terms of I can be empathetic, I can be understanding, but I will never see the world through the eyes of a Black man or a Black woman. Like, it's just impossible, right? So for me, it's like, it's just being able to take the pressure of having to think of the right thing to say for me, or having to be conscious about how I phrase things, and I get to just sit there and go, right, I'm just going to learn for this hour,
yeah,
hour, and, you know, whatever time length it is, I've just got to sit down, really listen. It's almost, there's like a meditative element to it, because it's the one time in those 2 weeks that I really don't have to think about what I'm doing outside of just going, listen, that's all. And, right, you know, you've provided just phenomenal guests, but I want you to speak to the idea of, I believe it started on a, did it start on a Monday or a Friday?
It did. It started on a Monday. No, yeah, it started on a Monday, and then the following one was Friday.
You get to Monday. Let's say you get to 30 minutes before you go live with part one. What's going through your mind, and how are you feeling about what you're about to get into?
I'm freaking out because we had so many people. I wasn't ready for that. Nobody was ready for that. Up until then, like, the biggest Zoom call we had was like maybe 35 people. So the fact that there was by the morning of over 500 people and counting, and like it was all via DM and like a Zoom account that didn't go over 500, and like we had like a pre-combo earlier, but 30 minutes before, people were still literally like in my DMs like, I want the link, I need the link, can I get the link? So like I was running around like a chicken with my head cut off. There was and then we just hopped on, and it started, and I was still getting, like, my phone was like going crazy, and like it was still buzzing, and like people were like, I didn't get it, I'm not in, and I'm like, I'm not knowing what to say to them. I'm like, I see people, like I thought everyone, you know. And then we find out like there were over like 700 people or something like that. So honestly, 30 minutes before, when I should have been in like a very like, whew, nervous, woosah, here we go, I was actually just like, is everybody like, are people going to get in? What is this? I didn't know this was going to happen. I thought we were going to have like 100 people top, like me, Tramell, Mike Press, and Jonas combined, we'll have like 100. And that was not the case. But once, I would say once the call started, that was when it all kind of set in, and our intentions and how we wanted to go about this. And I think we added Miles like that day, and then like Makia, I found out about her like the day before, and it was just like a lot happening. So yeah, 30 minutes before, it was just like chaos. So I was like, what's about to happen right now?
And then it like kept growing. It wasn't like, it wasn't like episode one happened and then there was a drop off. It was like, no, we're on, this is inclining, it's going up. So how have you found having to like just work everything out under somewhat of a duress, I guess, in terms of being like, God, I've got to like, you know, you've, first of all, you had the piece, the place of mind of being like, yeah, I better record these like just in case, because now they're podcast episodes. Like just that alone is like great that you've managed to work that out, because now you can listen to all the episodes on Spotify, Apple. Bryce has a website, and we'll plug everything at the end. But how was it like dealing with the growth as well? So you do one episode and then it's like, uh-oh, this is like getting bigger and bigger.
Just learning and growing. I mean, it was the perfect season for it. I'm just at home. But it was overwhelming. I'm not going to act like it wasn't like an overwhelming space to be in, but I think the mission outweighed like the pressure. The goal outweighed any other pressure. So, you know, now we've gone down to every Friday at 12:30 just to sort of manage. And like, and really be able to focus on the conversations, and building them in a way that is constructive and helpful. As well as the people joining, like making sure everyone's like good to go. But yeah, in the beginning, I think it would have been easy to crumble. But I had help. I had the help of about two or three people that I can count on. And now I have like a little mini team as far as like social media marketing, administration type stuff. So, and a lawyer. Shout out to my lawyer now. As far as business is concerned. But It was overwhelming, but I think the mission and the goal outweighed any potential pressure.
Yeah. This is a question that, I'll be perfectly candid, it's actually like, it's not specific to just you, but it's specific to, I guess, a lot of black people, a lot of people of color in this season. How have you managed to preserve your own emotional well-being, sanity, and you've had to experience, you know, COVID-19 and everything that comes with that. You've had to experience Amy Cooper and that situation with Christian Cooper. You've had to experience the George Floyd situation. And then you're now being leaned on by people like me, white people, as a platform for education. How have you managed to keep your own sanity, your own emotional well-being in a place that's good for you as the human being that's had to process everything that you've had to process whilst being leaned upon as someone that's like, you know, you've built for your discomfort and we just want more and more and more?
God, prayer. I'm not shy about my faith and my belief. I'm a Christian, so like prayer and God on site, like that's number one. Number two, I have an amazing girlfriend who supports just however she can. My parents support, friends and family support. And outside of that, dropping down to once a week has really helped preserve me as far as attention to detail and really putting my all into the conversations happening, because the turnaround time was crazy. From Friday to Monday, like that, that weekend time spent prepping for Monday was costly for everyone involved. And I'm so grateful for everyone that was a part of those, because they were obviously powerful conversations. But I think for me, just taking care of myself, dropping down to at least having the conversations once a week. I mean, things are literally happening all day, every day.
Yeah.
But having this the entire week to prep for a conversation has really fed me as far as my energy and my passion for this project, because there's just more time to get to know people. There's more time to prep. There's like a formula that is working. And I love that I can breathe more life into the one conversation than breathe a lot of life into one conversation and then like make it happen again in 3 days.
Yeah. It's just something that really crossed my mind, because you're having these highly emotional conversations in some parts, especially early on when the George Floyd news was as raw as it was. And I've described it as an earthquake that really like the whole world felt. And it's something I'm very conscious of and wanted you to speak on, just your own preserving yourself.
Yeah. Everything happens for a reason. The order of my life is very specific, because this is what I had to learn how to do as an actor, night in and night out. If I have a tragic scene, which I've, for whatever reason, I'm always in those, or my characters always go through some sort of tragedy, and being truthful in those moments and in those spaces to like go there, feel those feelings, mean it, and then process it that night and then wake up and be fine, which as fine as I can be, is a muscle that is, you know, you can't just do that all the time, because not healthy mentally and emotionally. So I'm just thinking about this right now, but I've been blessed to have to learn how to process very real, very honest, raw emotion daily, truthfully, and be healthy at the same time.
Yeah.
What you're describing is the same way people feel about performers or people doing a scene on camera or being interviewed. People think it just happens naturally. And there's always a level of prep, and there's always an emotional, physical, spiritual, mental toll that is taken.
Yeah. Completely agree. What are your hopes and dreams going forward that you're comfortable sharing, in terms of for you personally as Bryce Michael Wood, whether that's in acting, whether it's in the platform that you've built? Like, where do you see your life, I guess, going in this like near future?
I mean, it just took such a COVID really shifted a lot of trajectory, if you will. That said, you know, I believe that, you know, Bryce Michael Wood will be a name that people know, regardless of what I'm doing. And I think I'm going to leave it at that. Like, whether that's acting, whether that's the fitness world, whether that's as an activist, whether that's, you know, my own talk show, put it into the world, you know, whatever that is, whatever that looks like, I just, not even what I hope for, just what I feel. And what I know is that Bryce Michael Wood will be a known name worldwide for a variety of things. And I'll leave it at that. I hope that doesn't sound like cocky. It's something that is starting to happen. And it's a feeling that I've had. And I never knew what that would look like, but it's starting to shape up in a very specific way.
I like it. No, I'm cool with it. Right. Because I know I'll forget, and this is kind of something I've set a habit throughout the seasons of Gods of Eden, I want you to plug everything that you've got going on right now. Shameless plugs. And then we've got the final four questions, which are, although they've changed and evolved, they are the questions I ask every guest to finish the episodes.
All right. Shameless plugs, at Rice Knows on all social media platforms, at For Your Discomfort on all social media platforms. Go to foryourdiscomfort.com to donate. We need money, because we're not working. We will be having a fundraiser like within the next week that is going to fund brand new content, actual like quality stuff that I can't wait to start to highlight some of these people that we've been talking to in a more cohesive, more coherent, more personal way than just a live Zoom call and their voice on a podcast. If I had like an acting project, I'd put that out, but I don't, because they're not happening. If anybody wants to make something, hit me up.
There you go. I like it. Thanks, Bryce. Right. Final four questions. They have slightly evolved, but these four questions are loosely have been asked by answered by every guest, and they're slightly deeper questions, believe it or not. So this is kind of my way of finishing up, but this is the new one for, I guess, season 3.5. I recorded 5 episodes pre-COVID. We're still in season 3, but it's a time delay. But this is the new question. If I was to give you a megaphone that spoke to the entire world and you could share one message, what would it be?
It's not about being perfect. It's about being present.
Love that. Great. Number 2. What's your biggest personal struggle that not many people may know about right now?
My biggest personal struggle is saying no to things.
There you go. Number 3. What are 3 personality traits / characteristics that you would say you've built your life upon up to this point?
Progress is a process. Mm-hmm. Love without expectations. And if it's for you, it'll be yours.
Amazing answers. I'm a really big fan of all 3 of those. This is the final question. It used to be the one I used to get most uncomfortable asking. It's now actually my favorite question. But the last question. Many years into the future, your time as Bryce Michael Wood is coming to an end. The person closest to you only has 1 sentence to describe you and your time here on Earth. What would you hope that would be?
He loved with every bone in his body.
Oh, God. That's so perfect. I love it. Bryce, I'm super appreciative of your time. I know that you're very busy. Please, anybody listen to this, please go listen to For Your Discomfort. I promise. It will be an hour of your time that will open your mind and change your perspective or give you something. You're going to benefit listening to one of those episodes. That is like, and I don't even have to pick a specific episode. I know that you can go random lucky choice and just go bang. And I promise you that what Bryce has built has, they've really resonated with me in a major, major way. And I truly believe in what you're building, Bryce. I'm a huge fan of yours. I'm going to stay a fan of yours. And this has just been beautiful for me. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. And I need to listen to everything you've ever done, because now I'm a fan of yours as well.
Dude, check the Tramell one out. It's long, but I promise you that episode was amazing. Like that.
I'll check it out.
Thanks, let's say man. Goodbye to everyone. Peace out.
See ya.
One love.
White people.
Step into the room.